How can you end your service in a way that doesn't suck? That's what we talked about with Joe McLeod in an interview for my next book on how to create services that serve both humans and planet. Joe is the expert of endings. He wrote 2 books about it, helped companies like Fairphone implement beautiful ends, and he trains the next generation of designers to be engineers. People that are as strong in designing the end than the start. With Joe, we uncovered 10 early service design principles that can help you better design the end of a service. Here are my 5 favorites. Just ask, how does it end? Show how it will end at the start. Don't be a dick in the end. Be generous. Make sure the way it ends is like it starts. Use the end to let people experience your values and last time. Thank you so much to Joe for this lovely conversation. Hey, it's a pleasure to see you again, Joe.
And you, thanks very much for inviting me to talk on this.
It's such a pleasure because we've been working together on other projects related to HSLU, which is this design university in Switzerland. But today we're here to speak about other things also related to service design and about the work that you do. But before we get into all of that, I have a little starting question for you. When you go in a birthday party, how do you usually present yourself?
I usually say, like, I'm a designer on a very basic level. And I might start saying I design a specific part of the consumer experience and I look at endings. And then I talk about my work around that. And then people are interested in the course and the training program and the books. And so the conversation often opens up more from there.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit what is kind of like the big idea around these 2 books and also the courses that come with it?
I guess, like many things, you go on a journey of investigation. And for many years, I was making products and starting experiences. So making new things, attracting people to that product, making something innovative that's new and would solve some sort of problem in people's lives. And that could have been anything from, most of the time, it was digital things. And after a while, I started looking into the end of the consumer experience. I first started looking at closure actually as an experience, closure experiences, but then expanded that into endings. And then I really got deep into that, looked at the historical, sociological sort of context around that. And that was the first book, the Ends book, which that came out in 2017. And that was really eye-opening. And from that foundation of knowledge, I started to build up a sort of a discipline around how to design the end of the consumer experience. And I called it Endoneering. And the second book came out in 2021. And now I've built a business around that and a training program, and people become Endoneers, of which many people from HSLU have become Endoneers. And yes, yeah, so that's how this story has started. So it wasn't just I think I'll write an ends book. It was very much a journey of experience that's happened over 15, 20 or even more years of learning. And now I feel like there's something there.
In the few times we met and in the few talks that I could join from you, there was always kind of like one shift that I really appreciated in how you explained this, where there is this notion of we put so much energy in bringing people in a service. We're very good at selling it, making it look shiny, making it seamless that we get started. You know, that's kind of like the whole marketing bit where we're very good at that. And then in service design, we're quite good at the maintaining bit, you know, making sure that people, you know, enjoy all parts of it. And then you ask this question, which I think is a very provocative and good question, which is, what if we put as much energy that we put in the start for marketers and in the service for service designers and service owners for the end? What would happen if the end would have as much love, as much energy, as much passion than the rest of it. And I think that was for me kind of like a very interesting bit where, as a service designer, I include the end in the work, you know, but still as a important bit, but not as, oh, this should have at least as much love and energy as the other parts.
Exactly. And I think I always find it fascinating how when you go into a business and you observe anyone in that business talking about the product that they've created, whether that be a physical service or digital product, and they're incredibly confident of what it is and how it works and how it functions. And anyone can talk with nuance and confidence about that. But to that point is that if you ask them the simple question of how does it end, it's incredible how ignorant even people who've built the product really see how it ends. And when you don't look at the end in those, just on the very simplest thing, it becomes very paralyzing to start creating that ending. And because we have so much catching up work to do in many companies and businesses, I find it how quick that move from the end of the consumer usage period to the fallout, which isn't really a planned ending, it's a capturing of the end by society, the environment. And that's essentially where everything falls. It turns from, I bought this amazing thing, to now it's some dimension of plastic that I'm, as a consumer, responsible for, and I've been abandoned from the rest of the experience.
Thinking about the end of a thing that I buy, a product, it's very clear why we should care about it, because we say, oh, if it ends up in the trash,
yes,
that's lost, you know, nothing happens. But why should someone who's creating a service, which is something more intangible, also care about that ending? Because it's something that is intangible. So it didn't really exist before. Once it's ending, it doesn't exist anymore too. So why are endings important?
I think let's look at a couple of examples. So from point of a membership business, for example, which essentially services like a community, some sort of club or group, or so it's amazing when I engage with services like that, that they will look at the solution of somebody ending the experience, not as let's design a better ending, but let's double down on trying to sell more beginnings. And those are two different questions, really. So I think when I go into businesses of all sorts, financial services, when I talk to people in financial services like banks, their perception of the end isn't one of a place to do good work and create a consumer experience. It's one of fear and blindness and paranoia. And it drives them to not say, let's design a better ending, let's design a new beginning. And one of the funny things I get when I go into businesses, they say, oh yeah, well, if we have a good ending, then we'll have a good beginning. And I use that as a litmus test, because if all they see the ending for is a transition from the state of usage to the new beginning, then they haven't thought about that at all. And it really gives me a sense of their it and the absence of this discussion. And I think also we have this as a problem in a society, a community problem in design, because over generations we've got to this place where onboarding and usage are important and endings we're blind to.
I like this litmus test of saying, are we doing an ending so that we can get people into something else? Or are we designing the ending of the proper end? And I think that's quite an interesting way to see, oh, am I really doing an end here?
Exactly. So if you create a very good ending, what you're building is a longer term relationship and a reputation, which is going to be better for your product experiences in the future. It's also when you look at the end, you really start to understand what you've missed in other parts of the consumer life cycle, because when you start to tie things up, you can see lots of threats that you haven't resolved in a practical way. So data, for example, is a massive problem at Endings because we just let it linger. We create very complex databases and we look at the scenario of them in usage, and then we don't create scenarios where consumers can unravel that type of their reputation and their data in those databases and remove it.
So by, if I get you right, by thinking about the end, it's not only just thinking about the end, it makes us realize elements of our service or the experience that aren't designed that well, because we have a hard time ending them.
Absolutely. An analogy of that could be writing stories and films or any narrative structure. Humans love narrative structures. We've been using them as ways to tell stories and communicate with over generations for thousands of years. And if you said to anyone about a story, the end of that story brings resolution, meaning, and conclusion to the experience that you've had. But what we've tended to do in consumer experiences is create a status that is in the middle, and you're constantly in this story without resolution. And so if you look at that analogy and think, if I remove the end of the story, what would be the purpose of the other components in the second act? Or if we have the three-act play, first act, second act, third act. Third act brings resolution and meaning to all of those other things that you've got in previous acts. So when you remove the end and don't think about the end, you actually haven't really thought through what the finality is of those components that you've created for the rest of the consumer experience.
It feels like, you know, these films or stories where it ends and you're like, but they opened a thing here with the umbrella.
Yeah.
And where's the umbrella now? What happened with that thing?
It's the continuity problem, isn't it? If you've got, and you're just, at the end, you see so many problems where they haven't thought things through. And it's a massive problem, and spending years doing it, you see the problems all over the place and think, how did you even get this far? So, yeah. I think it's also worth coming back and giving you another couple of examples in healthcare, for example, which is obviously a massive and very important service aspect, is that when we do healthcare, we think about diagnosis. So this person has this problem. We then think about a cure. So we then engage with that problem and then solve it. And we never really offboard the human from those things. So you have lots of situations where people have been tutored in how do you communicate bad news to a patient. Yeah, you have this problem. There's actually a lot of work that goes on around that. I'd say that's an onboarding experience into this bigger service experience. And then you have lots of work around, okay, we're going to inform the person about these things that we're going to do to make them better again. And there's lots of work that goes on around that. And it's surprising how little work, after it's all done and it's solved, how little work there is really around the goodbye bit. And it isn't about, obviously everyone's going to be really pleased about the resolution of their problem and they've solved the problem, but how we say goodbye is a really important thing in the human way as well. A good example of this is a thing called the end of treatment bell, and they've been using this in cancer wards for a good couple of decades now. And it was the story I got told of how it got introduced into the UK, at least, was this. There was this little girl and she had a pretty severe type of cancer, and getting treated in the UK in amongst this other children's ward, lots of poor kids. And she ends up going to America for some special treatment, and she is lying there in this children's ward. And then she sees this kid get up and ring this massive bell at the end of the ward. And she's then absolutely fascinated by this and asks the doctors and nurses what that was. And they say it's the end of treatment bell. Once you've finished your treatment, you can get up and ring this bell. And she was thought this was really exciting. So she told the, when she went back to the UK, she told the doctors and nurses at her hospital, and they installed one, and she was the first person to ring it. And the great thing about the end of treatment bell is that what's happened over many periods before that is complications if, or complicated term, lots of really difficult situations of having treatment and all of these really difficult things and doubts and concerns. And what is amazing about the end of treatment bell is that how it cuts through everything. It's been, you've been restricted in this very complex system that has loads of processes, and you haven't been able to give yourself out and shout about it. But this is a loud thing. It rings around. It's very visual as well, because it's very different from everything else. And it has a really good statement about this is the end. And now there's a charity that puts end of treatment bells in loads of children's wards all around the UK. And I think they have them in lots of countries now, because it's such a good conclusion to a very different situation. I think those are really good examples of how endings can have emotional meaning beyond the best care at other periods and the things, that you've got this really powerful, very emotive ending and punctuation.
Yeah, I really love this aspect of the ending as also kind of like a ritual aspect, you know, and a transition maybe to another part of life.
Yeah.
So from sick to healthy, from hospital to back home, from... So there is a lot of emotions, a lot of rituals in there that help the human. Yeah. I'm asking myself, how does that relate to other parts? So there is obviously an aspect which is serving the human well. And I know that you're someone who is very interested also in circularity and all of these thoughts. So, and it's quite clear to me that taking care of the end of a product has a lot of value for the emotional side of the human and for the practical side of the planet. But what would be the positive sides of a good service ending for not just the human, but maybe the system in general?
I think, yeah, so it's a very human experience, the end of treatment bell. I think something like membership organisations, where they've built all of the other aspects of that experience and haven't really considered what that means to say goodbye. And it reminds me of somebody who I taught really early on when I was doing endings. And they had a company, they were some sort of media company. So essentially offering a service of doing design or something, marketing, I think it was. And one of their big clients announced that they were going to leave and go to a competitor. And he thought to himself, we're going to try out this endings thing and see what happens. So he spent loads of time and effort building the best offboarding experience, pulling all of the resources together, building a great big sort of database for them, and then giving them an amazing presentation and conclusion and farewell party. And so he spent a lot of time doing this, and they were really impressed by this, even though they were leaving and they didn't have any work off this company. They said goodbye and they thought it was really amazing, gave this work to a new company. And then a couple of months later, they come back to him with a bigger project than they ever had before, and because they were so impressed with the ending. And I think there's a lot to be said about doing a good ending isn't about your immediate business, but it's about delivering your reputation. And your reputation lives on in a different world beyond where you are. And that is true of humans and businesses. That if you're proud enough and confident enough to say goodbye confidently and emotionally, coherently, and I think generously as well, that will come back to you and your business and your benefit and learn from it. And I think it will make you feel more proud as well.
It feels like a good divorce, you know, where people obviously have for reasons, you know, to separate, but then where they get to another stage of the relation where, if they have kids, they can still function as parents together.
Yes,
Maybe not
at
as a couple, but then they still function in different ways. If there is, I love this aspect of generosity. That's a thing that I often hear in divorce, where one side maybe said, like, I wouldn't have had to offer this, but I've made this generous gesture, and this brought a resolution of, okay, this person doesn't want me to be in a bad situation. And then that allowed for the relationship to continue in some other way that was still beneficial for all involved.
I think that's a good example. Divorce is a really good example of a lot of this, where you see these relationships, and I write about that a lot in the first book, especially around the aspect of religion and how religions frame some of this stuff and make actually a lot of complications around people who have been bonded together in some way, marriage, and can't depart. And when you can't depart, there's a lot of evidence. Let's say in the US, there's different types of divorces you can have around the world in many progressive countries, and which is a fault divorce or a no-fault divorce. So no-fault divorces allow both partners to come together and say, this isn't really working, we want to divorce. And a fault divorce, which happens to be in the UK, requires one party to say that they've done something. And in the UK, there's five different things that you can say that you've done. So they can be, they've been absent. So my mum went through a, she wasn't really married, but in a legal sense, she had a property and ownership with somebody. He disappeared for 2, 3 years, and that all then came to her. My father had to say that something was, he took one of those faults. So also, it damages you as an individual. You know you haven't done anything bad, but you have to say something wasn't right. And so he said something wasn't right for him. And so you're immediately into this negative scenario in terms of that future life that you're talking about. Thankfully, neither of those examples had kids. But if you've immediately got onto a ground of somebody's to blame, then that isn't a good foundation for a future relationship. So then you go to countries that have no-fault divorces, and couples can get have a divorce and be a lot more confident in having a future together and working on things together, whether that be kids or equity or whatever. And so in the US, there's states that have fault divorce against states that have no-fault divorce. And in the no-fault, in the fault divorce states, there's a higher incidence of domestic violence, murder of partners. And so there's this incredible, tangible evidence of how divorces need to be matured into a no-fault divorce situation.
And how would you say we could create some no-fault divorces in services? What makes it that an ending feels like a place where it's not about the blaming, it's not about that element, but more about, okay, this is not working. It's okay. Let's move on.
So, in all of the work I do, I try and think about providing models and techniques that can be applied to physical digital service sectors in consumer experiences. That's where I work. But I think for everyone as a business, you've got to ask that first question is, how does it end? And that's super practical and it's super accessible for anyone to ask. And once you start looking at how does it end, then you start seeing, in a crude, boring way, what's your local legislation for disposing of your product in a physical sense? What are the laws around data? There's some really boring background stuff, but it will help you understand where that sort of starts to emerge in the foreground. Then it's worth doing like some just very practical stuff of going through the offboarding experience of your products. So what happens when, and then trying to work that out yourself. But then doing the practical research of asking people, real people, like what it was like to leave our business. And it's not a matter of We can certainly say, okay, we'll ask some questions on the way out. Would they recommend us to a friend? That's a really very shallow version of what really goes on. So we've got to get deeper than that. You've got to ask more than, would you recommend our business? And once you start digging into that, then you can start to see the real problem space and that emotional experience of people offboarding. And once you've got to there, you've now started to really dig into the problem and to find tangible information of what it means for your business and your customers leaving. And then you can start to look at some models of how to improve that. Because up until then, you hardly have even conversations around it. So you've got to ask, how does it end first? And then applying those models that I've created in the, for example, one of them is about types of endings. So a timeout ending, a credit out ending, task event completion ending, those eight types of endings are worth looking at because they help you narrow down what are we talking about and how can we like dig into this with more insight. So there's lots of those in the engineering book.
So a first step is asking how does it end, then maybe looking at is one of these eight types the type that would make most sense for our service. What else do you have in the world of, you know, you said it's very practical when it comes to endings, obviously. Do you have any other practical insights? You said, hey, it's also good to look at what are the laws and the legislations, because usually there is stuff in there that's quite clear on what you should do, but maybe you didn't know.
Another enormous dimension of it is how much effort it's going to be to deliver. So if you're talking about a physical product company, the reverse logistics of getting that product back and delivering that product to your dismantling center or your waste center, that's an incredible ask. And so there's a lot of work to be done there. Where that's arguably, if you're building the offboarding experience to an app that has no other responsibilities, then what you're doing is tidying up a data background. So you're asking the consumer to understand depending on your region, the legislation around data deletion, how long that's going to last. Often, I think for Europe now, it's 2 years you can hold on to it. But you could also build it in to really delete it at that time. And what does the consumer want? And I think there's a real also a responsibility, especially in the data world of teaching as well. There is such a lot of complicated stuff around the longevity and the ownership of data, which most consumers are really ignorant about. And I think there's a response and should be a pride if you've offered a good product earlier on, that if someone's leaving, you need to inform them about their risks and their responsibilities and the local legislation and your responsibilities as a provider as well.
I really appreciate this aspect of, and it comes back to one of the ideas that you said before, but this, once you think about how does it end, then suddenly you realize, oh, maybe we should change how we do things so that it's easier to make them end. And so maybe you even say that we might stop doing a few things so that it's easier to do the end. For example, you might say, hey, if we don't collect that piece of data that we don't really use, but we thought it's good because, you know, we always have this idea of more data might be useful sometime. And then suddenly we are in a situation where we say, if we don't collect that piece of data, we don't have to dispose of it at the end. So that makes our work a little bit easier.
One of the aspects I do workshops around is ends at onboarding. Because actually we don't tell consumers a lot about the end of the onboarding. Yet those are important aspects to consider. If you're Daniel Pink, the sales guru, says this really good phrase, if you're trying to make a sale, it's a lot easier for the customer to take the on-ramp when they can see the off-ramp. And actually, so when customers want to sign up for things, and because they've been stung so much in the past, once they sign up for things, they want to see the end of that. And how do I get out of this contract? How do I get out of this relationship? And actually, it's surprising how little we do that in a lot of fields. Another aspect of endless onboarding, if you think about the over the last sort of 20, 30 years, in terms of food products in certain regions, giving traffic light scheme things for this has got lots of salt, this has got lots of sugar, this has got lots of calories. That really helps people. So we do good work in other aspects of consumerism around indicating the end. And when I come to businesses and they want to design endings, one of the biggest failings that they've done in the past is that they haven't talked about the end at all. So the end then comes as a surprise for the consumer. And so if you're, as a business, aware of how it ends in your particular customer offering, if you design for that at the end, but also acknowledge that in throughout the rest of the consumer lifecycle, you're going to have such a better product in terms of being holistic and mindful, and especially when it comes to the end, it will be so much more smoother.
Absolutely. This reminds me of a thing that many Christian communities do, where they have at the start, when you commit to membership in a community, they quite clearly say, okay, this is a commitment for so much time. And then we'll review if it's still something that you feel makes sense for you. And in the places where I've seen this work and be implemented, you see really a big difference between places that have that and places that don't have that. Places that have that have members who are committed, who say, I'm here because I chose to be here and I had the chance to escape it. Yeah. And then there's other communities where people are like a bit, yeah, I'm coming because, you know, it's tradition and because I have to. And I thought about leaving, but, you know, it's kind of hard to have that conversation with someone saying, you know, I've been here for 20 years and what will happen to my friends? You know, maybe I will lose friends if I leave. And where giving the opportunity for a possible ending again and again and again suddenly makes it clear that it's not going to be something that we will shame you on. It's not going to be something that you will lose rights and access. It's just that it's natural to think about that. But it gives also the opportunity to the service owner to say, I think you're not a good fit, which is also an interesting bit, whereas it gives the opportunity to both sides to recommit to the relationship.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting in sales, where we do a lot of allowing people into a certain region of the product offering. And then you can try this out for a period of time. And I always find it interesting, those boundaries are essentially endings. That what types of boundaries do they put up to offer in a potential customer to give them a free version of it for X amount of time? So these can be a periodic thing, so you get it for 1 month. That's a tangible ending. This is, you've got access to this for 1 month. You can have it in terms of access to features. So you've only got access to these features. If you want to go further, then you're going to have to sign up for the bigger one. And there's lots of stuff where we've really played around with some of those things of endings at the beginning, and as a marketing ploy to encourage and move people forward. And as you say, in a similar sense, it's if I've got no other option than signing up for £100 a year, and then I find out actually this really isn't what I thought it was going to be, I'm going to be as soon as I can trying to get out of that. And I had a thing which was, it's a piece of accountancy software, and they just had such poor thinking around, or they had such poor customer thinking. And you could feel the aggression of the sales team saying, we've got to do this one, and we sold it there. And once we sell it, no, they can't get out. And it's such a old school 1950s way of looking at the world. So I think a good way of looking at the world, especially in the last sort of 10, 20 years, is to say that we've digitized so much of our customer lifecycle, or many, whether it be digital or service sector stuff, we've digitized so much of that. So I don't have to speak to a human being at all when I'm looking at a product. I look at reviews online, they're impartial by members of the public. I look at what the features might offer. So I have incredible knowledge that I'm doing at my own pace, and then I start to make a value judgment about, do I want to get this product? And then I sign up for it on the website and I'm a member of that business, that product, etc. And then I use that product. I never speak to a human at all. So this whole system has been digitized and everything about it is digital, whether it be on the desktop or the app. And then all of a sudden, when I want to leave, we turn into the 18th century. We start to use a phone that was created in like early 19th century rather. And we start to use human beings again. And then all of a sudden, this sales tactics from the 1950s emerge alongside it, which what we should be doing is digitizing the end of the customer experience as we have done the rest of the consumer lifecycle. And then all of those people in the call center don't need to have those horrible conversations with people to try and sell them another month or 6 months of a service. They can get on with building and making the rest of the service a good product. So we have terrible perception of the end as being a place where we should go back to the previous century.
We could even say we could do it in the opposite way, you know, where if it's something that is a very luxurious experience of pure human concierge onboarding, to say the end should have the same flavor and shouldn't be just one tap button exit thing, where it will feel at odds with your whole experience is very tailored, soft, human made, then I expect the end to also be it. But if the onboarding was very digital, one click get in, then I expect the same one click get out.
Absolutely. So look at it on a brand level. If you said to a company, tell us how you do this, and what we start with our brand and we do this through our brand principles and we deliver it through this color palette and this way. And that goes on for everything around the company, whether that be entering the office or their website or their branded business vans or whatever. But when it comes to the end, so many of them just adopt a let's try not to let anyone leave type of mindset. So brand principles that they're proud of at the beginning of the customer life cycle, for example, a cliche would be we're transparent and we're honest. These tend to be not recognized at the end of the customer life cycle. So they end up being not transparent, not honest, trying to avoid you leaving. So we should be looking at the end as a place to be brand first as well. Be honest. Companies say brave, and which they should be more brave about the end. And generous, like we talked about earlier as well, that these people leave your product for two reasons. Either they don't like your product, for a number of reasons, or external factors. And when businesses think about the end, they think, we've got to trap them here. And that solution has neither answers the external factors thing or our product's not good for them. And so you end up with this terrible scenario where customers leave and they won't go back to businesses, and businesses go on and try and find another customer.
I'd like to switch gears for the few last minutes we have.
Yeah.
With what's something unexpected, weird, funny, you know, that you learned about endings? Do you have a story or anything where you say, oh, this is really something that most people think A, but in fact it's B, or something that you say, oh, wow, this is really special about the way we should think about ending, or an example that you say, oh, this is very inspiring because it's just another way to do it.
Oh, actually, one thing I did think when I was researching the first book, I was doing stuff on credit cards and because of the changes of payment periods. And so I was looking at that and I was reading the history of Diners Club. In fact, maybe I'll do two. So I'll do this one. The history of Diners Club card. And the people who got that together, they literally started it by just saying, I want a credit line at these for having lunch, and they were doing this in New York. And ever since, in the credit card industry, that meal that they had, the first one with the Diners Club card, was called the First Supper. And I thought that was a really funny little bit of consumer history. Another one which I think is, I find really terrifying, and is how long ago Coca-Cola introduced 2 litre plastic bottles into their, and it was like 1973. They had a big press conference in again, actually in New York. Big press conference, loads of people come. They do a Q&A and tell everyone about this incredible product that they've created. And they promise they're going to roll this out. And they're, because it's recyclable, they're going to create all of these recycling centres around the world. Wherever they distribute products, they're going to create recycling centres. And of course, when we now, I find it quite frustrating when we talk about plastics in the sea. Instead of talking about the offboarding experience, we talk about the material capability of the thing. And this is, I think, one of the fundamental mistakes that we have in sustainability or around the that problem space of pollution, is that we talk about material capability. And no customers are really interested in that. That's a different conversation. And it really stems, I think, back to a conversation that was happened when they launched fully recyclable plastic bottles, that the material doesn't really matter. It's the capture that matters. And the capture is everything to do with the consumer offboarding experience. And the more we have conversations about the capturing method, not the, and the consumer experience and not the material experience, I think we'd get a lot further. And it frustrates me when I see so many novel new materials coming out when it doesn't really matter. We don't capture the most recyclable plastic bottle that's been around forever. It won't matter if you make a new material, because we won't capture it anyway. We just dump it in the sea like the rest of it. The capture is where we need to work.
Absolutely. And so if people are curious for becoming an engineer, what's the first tiny step you recommend for the ones that are just saying, I just want to dip my toes into it? And what's the recommendation that you will give for people who say, oh, I want to jump in the water and learn to swim?
So, that's a really good way of putting it. I think if you just want to dip your toes in the water, you can visit the website andn.co. I think also at work, just ask the question, how does it end? In fact, ask that question in a product development meeting, because everyone finds it really annoying and no one will have an answer. And that'll be even funnier for your product, your day at work. If you really want to dig into it, then I very much suggest you start with the ENDS book. It's where I started. And that is my journey as well, to start asking that question about why we don't do endings in consumerism. And the story really goes back many centuries. And it's, I find it a fascinating story, and it changed my mindset to then really engage in this subject matter. And thereafter, I hope you come along with the journey and do the second book and then become an engineer and get in touch.
It's always lovely to learn from you each time.
Thank you.
You know, you are at HSLU or I see some of your work online. It's always a big pleasure, you know, and over the years it has really slowly but surely changed the way I perceive ENDS, and I'm really thankful to you for that. I'm also thankful because you're taking time, some very precious time, to help me in the research for this tiny upcoming book that I'm writing at the moment. And I really, really appreciate it. As I told you before we were recording this, always have this amazing quality of the simplicity of how we can make things happen with you is something that I've always been impressed. You're not just a master of how to make things end, but also on how to get relationships started. So that's a thing that I
do. Oh, thank you. Thanks very much, Daniel. It's wonderful. It's been wonderful getting interviewed by you. You have a lovely manner in your interview style.
Really appreciate it. Hey, thank you so much, and wish you a lovely rest of the summer.
Thank you very much. See you later.